Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
This February, an Garda Síochána will celebrate 100 years since their formation in Ireland. As careers go in the force, few can rival Pat Murray's and the success he's had in solving intricate and serious crimes. Every detective's career has to start somewhere, and as previously told, Pat's began in an underwhelming stint playing cardboard cutout on Merrion Road. But when you ask him when things really began, he gives you a different answer. For Pat, things only really took off around 2001.
I was promoted, sent to Clonus for 2.5 years, then transferred to Balbriggan, where I took up there as detective sergeant.
For a young detective trying to work their way up the ranks, Pat's stint in Balbriggan was a successful one. By 2003, he'd won his first merit award, an achievement received by clamping down on drug dealing and making a number of large seizures in the district. By 2004, he was on the beat, busy solving Rachel Callaly's murder and making a name for himself within the force. But back in March 2001, Pat would find himself at the beginning of a case that would become, in his opinion, the first major crime in which he would lead from the front. This cat and mouse chase spans 3 different countries and would eventually take Pat 4 whole years to deliver justice to the victim's family. The Making of a Detective is brought to you by the Irish Sun. I'm Ian Doyle.
Superintendent ringing me, he says, that flute's after going missing. I think his car is after being found up at the Hill of Hoat, he says, so you might go up and have a look.
He looked at me and he said, you better sit down. And I did. And then he looked around at my mum and dad and everyone said, you all better sit down.
This is our second case of Pat Murray's career and will be delivered in multiple parts. If you've enjoyed the series so far, take a moment and leave us a review in your podcast app. Or even better, tell a friend about the show.
Mary and I met at the school gate, primary school in Stamullen. And I didn't want to go into school because I was half crying. So she took me by the hand and brought me into school. That was the very first day I met Mary, and our relationship just was building from that day on.
Some friendships are worth their weight in gold. People you can rely on, confide in, the people that make you laugh. Those friends, whose lives are so entwined in your own, that your shared memories are some of the fondest ones you hold dear. That was and is the case for Sinead Howard Byrne and her best friend Mary Gough. Sinead speaks from her kitchen in her home in Stamullen. less than 100 metres away from her family home and a stone's throw away from the Goths. Their friendship is a uniquely special one. Inseparable from day one, their whole childhood was spent together. Their teens and their 20s too. They came as a package.
She had not got lots of confidence, neither would I. That's probably part of why we got on so well. But she was quiet and she was funny, but she just was reserved. She was a reserved girl, and a lovely, kind, caring girl, loved animals. She always, grown up, had a dog called Jasper.
The years flowed on and the girls started secondary school together, sharing sweet and funny memories in class and often trying to avoid it.
The school principal came down in his car and he spotted the two of us walking home, knew we weren't supposed to be walking home, and he turned the car and came back, and we were absolutely mortified. And he came up to the two of us and said, "Where are you going?" And we said we were heading home, and I had my letter, so I was all right. But he took Mary back into the car and headed back to school with a massive big red face on her. She was so mortified. It was unbelievable. But yes, we did lots of things like that.
In 1989, their friendship escalated into something quite different. A tragic incident that would further tighten their bond.
Mary was part of our family. She was a huge part of our family. She was really... Her own dad died when she was very young, so my dad and her dad were friends. So we took Mary in, really, like a sister. Mary was like a sister and a daughter to us as well.
As they grew older, boys eventually came on the scene. Sinead met her husband Pat when they were just 16.
And Mary came with us. Like, we went out for our dinner for Valentine's night to the Rosnery in Drogheda at the time, and Mary came along with us. So there was three of us for our Valentine's dinner.
Mary found love too. In 1993, she met Colin Whelan in the Huntsman Inn in Gormanston, County Meath. The two were in their late teens and hit it off immediately. Colin had dark hair and was a tall, well-built, handsome man. Mary was short, with brunette hair and dark eyes, and took huge pride in her appearance. As a pair, they looked great together, and she seemed happier than ever.
We all loved going out for food, and then they would come to our house and have pizza nights and have movie nights and always just doing things together. It was no different, really. We were very happy. As four, we were very happy.
Let's rejoin Pat Murray on Thursday, the 1st of March, 2001. A blustery morning on Greg's Lane, County Navan. Pat's at home in bed in a house he built himself. A moment to savour for the busy detective after getting a rare full night's sleep.
It's funny how it goes. I left my phone charging in the kitchen of my house, and when I got up the next morning, I went down to check the phone and get my breakfast, and I saw there was 40 missed calls on my phone, and I was looking through it, and most of them were from my superintendent, and I said, "Oh God, I'm in trouble here."
Wasting no time, Pat picked up his phone and rang his superintendent back. He knew a bollocking would await him on the other end of the line.
"Oh," he said, "it's great that you answered the phone." I said, "Well, I had it charging in the kitchen and didn't hear it." Like, "Oh, well, it must be great to live in such a big house that you can't hear your phone ring, you know." He says, "Anyway, luckily," he says, "we had a death here last night. A woman allegedly fell down the stairs and she died, and we have the house preserved," he says.
By the commotion caused and the missed calls, he felt it might be more than just a simple accident.
We took a statement from the husband, who's saying that there was only two of them in the house at the time, and his wife fell down the stairs. But he says, "We were above at the hospital, myself and Garda Jim O'Byrne," and he says, "a cute nurse up there saw a scratch on his chest, and we asked him to be examined, you know, for shock purposes and all that, and he took his shirt off, and there was a big scratch mark on his chest."
I will never forget the night that I heard the news. We were in bed, it was late. I lived down the road in Mountain View, and there was a knock on the door. My dad knocked on the door, my husband ran downstairs, and I was halfway down the stairs. And he opened the door, and I knew by looking at my dad's face, it was bad. So I looked and I just said, "Who?" I just knew it was who, and he said, "Mary." And I said, no, 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 it can't be my Mary. And he shook his head to say, yes, it is. It's Mary. She had a fall down the stairs. And I just remember sitting back onto the middle of my own staircase and thinking, no, this can't be happening. And start thinking, how could this have happened? And then I said, maybe she fell over a muffin. And we decided, Dad said, do you want to go up to the hospital? Up to Beaumont? And I said, yes. So he took my husband and I, Dad drove us up to the hospital. And it just went from there. It was absolutely horrendous. It was devastating news.
The scratch on Colin Whelan's chest didn't look good. Still though, Pat knew it was important to keep an open mind. His superintendent wanted him to go and view the body, so Pat visited the Dublin City Mortuary. It was a place he'd become more familiar with as his career progressed. There he met Dr. Mary Cassidy, Ireland's deputy state pathologist at the time, a tall, blonde and good-humoured Glaswegian who would go on to have one of Ireland's most distinguished medical careers. Pat sat outside her office, waiting for her report on what must have happened.
And she came out and she said to me, I have good news and bad news. And I says, well, I says, hit me with the good news first. And she says, well, the good news is that I'm finished the post-mortem, but if it was any other pathologist, you'd be waiting another 4 hours. Well, I said, that's good news. And what's the bad news? And she says, you have a murder on your hands.
This wasn't something that particularly shocked Pat. The early signs from the nurse's statement indicated that things weren't right.
I says, I don't mean to sort of doubt you, I says, but how sure are you that this is a murder, or should this girl has been strangled? Come in here and I'll show you.
The two entered the examination room, a cold and clean, lab-like facility, not too dissimilar from what you might see in a movie. Mary's body was lying in front of them. It was hard not to feel sadness for her. Dr. Cassidy points to the first indications of an attack.
She says the hemorrhaging under the eyes and the swollen tongue, and she said she has a mark on the side of her neck here, which is a burn mark, which was she was strangled with something, and there's no doubt she is strangled. And I said, look, she's wearing a necklace there. I could see a chain. I said, could she have fallen on that cot in the banister? No, 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 she says, take it from me. She says, absolutely, she was strangled with a ligature, like, you know, with force. And it's nothing got to do with anything else. And one of the other things Mary Cassidy told me, she says, her injuries are not consistent with a fall down the stairs. And she showed me the burn marks on the bottom of Mary Goff. She said, look, it appears she has these burn marks from being dragged. So I rang my superintendent and I told him, he says, well, how are you getting on? Well, I says, you want to sharpen your pencil? I said, because we have a murder.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promoting for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Colin and Mary married in September 2000, just 6 months before she would die. Naturally, Sinead was her bridesmaid on the day, and the pair spent months planning the occasion. Things between them hadn't always been plain sailing. In the years up to their engagement, there had been a few short splits, but the pair were always quick enough to patch things up. Sinead was due to marry her own partner, Pat, in September 2001, exactly 12 months out from Mary and Colin's wedding. Once her own wedding had finished, Mary got stuck into helping Sinead plan for her own big day. It helped keep them in contact on a near daily basis, and both were so excited about the future ahead.
We went out for our food and we did exactly the same as we always did, but our wedding was coming up and Mary was helping me out with the wedding, and she actually was to come out. If Mary didn't like the colour I picked for bridesmaids, I wouldn't go with it. That was it. It was just she had to like it, and she was to come out to us on Pancake Tuesday. She was coming to her mam first and then coming to me to see the piece of material, which I still have, just to show her did she like it. But she never got out because it was snowing. It was snowing very heavy and it was too bad to travel. She just was very excited that it was coming up, and it looks like now he knew she was never going to see the wedding. And actually, she never got to see the piece of material because it happened the next night.
When Pat's lining up a new investigation, he's always keen to follow his process. An incident room is established, and the Gardaí get to work on various aspects of the case. Before moving on to interviews and statements, Pat's ground zero is always dependent on what information is there at hand.
And the first thing I did was, I said we should look at the alarm system.
Pat Murray is the type of detective that could work 20 hours in a day without hesitation. Throughout his career, he spent long, lonely hours upskilling and trying to get ahead of any technology that might aid him in a case. One example of this was a qualification in ham radios. Essentially, non-commercial radio transmission.
To get the qualification, I had to build a radio and stuff like that. And I knew about pulses and electrics in that respect. And I knew that it was a phone watch system they had in the house.
Pat knew that with their particular system, even if the alarm was powered off, signals would still register into its internal log if a window or door was opened in the house.
And I said we should get that printed out. And that's exactly what we did. We got onto an engineer in phone watch, and they came out and downloaded the log from the alarm system, and they were able to say the time Colin and Mary came back into the house that evening, and from the time she was killed or he rang the 999, there was no other interference with doors or windows or anything that no one else could have got in, like, you know, or open doors or anything of that nature. So here we had Colin Whelan in the house with his wife, and him admitting that he was the only person there, the alarm system verifying that no one else could have got in. And we had the pathologist saying that this girl has been strangled, you know. So what does that leave us to think other than that Colin Whelan killed his wife?
It was going to be important for Pat to have an in-depth description of Colin's account of that night. If Dr. Cassidy was right, and this was a murder investigation, Pat would be able to pick out any discrepancies in the story. The thing was, though, Dr. Cassidy was never wrong. She was extremely skilled at her job, so Pat had no reason to believe that Mary hadn't been murdered.
Colin says that he was in the house, he was watching MTV USA or whatever.
This is Music Television USA.
Welcome back to New York, and this is a very famous American car, an Oldsmobile.
And his wife went up to have a shower. And he heard thump, 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 and he discovered that she had fallen down the stairs. He said there was no one else in the house, only himself and his wife, and that he rang 999 and the ambulance arrived. When the emergency services got to the scene, Mary was wrapped in a duvet, and under that there was a towel that was bloodied. And the thing about the duvet, he was keeping the body warm, because there's no doubt Mary had been killed earlier than he had rang the emergency services.
Colin told Pat that the emergency responder on the phone had asked him to wrap the duvet around Mary's body while waiting for the ambulance to arrive.
But that call was recorded and there was no talk about any duvet whatsoever. So that was another lie, you know. Also, we seized the phone from the house and he was given the impression he was doing CPR. Now, he said that there was foam and blood in our mouth and this, that and the other, but he didn't have foam and blood on him and there was none on the phone. So he was obviously standing there doing nothing, like, you know. So if there was any semblance of life in Mary, he didn't care, like, you know. That was it.
When Colin Whelan left the house that night, the Gardaí preserved the scene immediately and nobody was let back in.
So everything was preserved, and in the bedroom, on forensic analysis and technical examination, we were able to discover between the ensuite door and the main door of the bedroom, on the wallpaper, there was, when you're being strangled, you blood vessels burst in your nose and you emit a mist of blood that's not visible to the naked eye. And it was on the wallpaper between those two doors. So we knew that she was strangled in that location when she came out of the ensuite. We also discovered that the robe that he had been wearing, his dressing gown robe, the belt on it, had Mary's saliva and DNA on the middle part of that belt. And it was taut. You could see it had been pulled, and we verified that through scientific analysis, and we were able to put her DNA on that at that point, you know. So we were quite satisfied the murder weapon was the belt of the dressing gown.
One of the skills that makes a great detective is decision making. Some decisions are based around facts or information at hand, but others have to be based around emotion and the victim's loved ones. Pat was in a difficult position. As the weeks went on in the case, he knew that he would have to inform the Gough family that all is not what it seemed.
I remember discussing it with the superintendent and saying, look, we'll have to be very tactful how we tell the family, because it says the two families are very united and they're very close. And I says, we'll have to take a certain approach instead of blurting it out, like, you know. And he says, what do you suggest? And I says, I think the best way to go about it is we'll call up to the Gough family and tell them that, you know, we're making inquiries and that we are not happy, but with the findings of the post-mortem matched against what Colin Whelan is saying happened that night. And that's just leaving it open without saying anything else. But then I says, we'll bring it on then to a stage. We tell them, like, you know, she has been murdered, but they may have had some sort of platform to land on to get the next bad news, you know. So we agreed on that, and we done that. We paid the Gough family a visit.
Pat drove out to Stamullen, County Meath, to visit the Gough family home. He knew that the news would devastate them.
And we spoke to Marie Gough, the mother, and her sons, and we made it clear that, look, we're investigating this and we want to be thorough, and but all deaths were very thorough, and that what Colin Whelan is saying happened that night is not consistent with what Mary Cassidy has told us she believes happened. So we're looking into that at the moment, like, you know.
The following day, in a search for more definitive information, one of Mary's brothers drove to Balbriggan Garda Station. He wanted answers.
He was brought to the superintendent's office and he was sat down. He wanted to know, what do you mean Mary Cassidy's findings are not, Colin? Surely she fell down the stairs or wherever. And there was no other way of breaking the news from just to tell him straight out. And we told him straight out, look, we believe Mary was murdered. We believe she was strangled. And we can confirm that. And her injuries are not consistent with a fall. And that's what we're taking from. We're investigating a murder now. Now the poor chap nearly fell off the seat. And what do you pussyfoot around? I don't believe in pussyfooting around, but I believe the approach we took gave them a little bit of cushioning for what was to come.
I was over at my mum and dad's house across the road, and we were all there, and Peter, Mary's brother, and his wife Liz came in to tell us the dreadful news. He just said, he looked at me and he said, you better sit down. And I did. And then he looked around at my mum and dad and everyone, said, you all better sit down. And then he told us this wasn't a fall down the stairs. This wasn't an accident. We found it very hard to take it in. It was silence in the room for a long time. Couldn't really understand what was going on.
Colin was one of Sinead's best friends. They'd grieved together about her loss. She couldn't wrap her head around the news. It was too painful to.
I didn't believe at the start that this could have been Colin. I really didn't. I would have stood up for Colin at the start, not having an idea that he could have done what he did do. And I thought, I didn't see any wrong in Colin at all. And I thought, this must be a mistake. So it took me a long time to get my head around it wasn't a mistake. I can't even really think about what happened to Mary. I never think about that on that night. I try not to think of what happened to her because I can't let that in on me.
Colin Whelan was a talented computer programmer, a job that, in 2001, very few people could do. He had his own company called Data Motions, which was contracted by Irish Permanent, a financial services company, and he worked full-time in their Dublin headquarters.
He was on a very good wage. He was looked after extremely well by Irish Permanent. In actual fact, I wouldn't mind earning that type of money now. But anyway, the fact that he was a computer programmer and he was now suspect for the murder of his wife, we said we would look at his computer background. And we said we conduct a search in his own house, obviously, and then we do a search in his workplace.
Pat and another officer drove out to the office in the hope to pick up any information that might aid their case. There he met a manager in the business who showed them to Colin's workspace.
It was one of these big, huge desks, but there was two computers on it, and they told us that computer was belonging to a lady. I'll never forget the name because it's a lovely name, Anne Wheatleam, and she said she's gone now. She's working in another part of Irish Permanent, and so this sort of twigged me, like, what's stopping Colin Whelan using that computer? We seized the computers and that, and I remember we took the whole desk out of it and brought the whole shebang, and there was even a waste paper basket at his desk, and there was one of those yellow stickers in it, and it had on it roses are red and violets are blue, you know, something I love you, or this type of rubbish on it. And I said, Flipper, we bring the bin and all, like, you know. So they gave us full access to the proxy server that recorded everything, and we were able to search through. There were 14,000 logs a day recorded on the system, and we had to go through each one of those logs.
In today's world, a computer search in a case of this magnitude seems like an obvious path for Pat to investigate, but that really wasn't the case in 2001. Back then, just over one quarter of Irish homes would have had access to a computer, and even less with access to the internet. In fact, this would be the first time a Garda investigation had ever formally tried to access computer data to build evidence in a murder case. A small detail in Pat's career, but another detail that distinguished him from the rest. Even now, 20 years on, Pat still can't believe how much they were able to derive from Colin's PC.
He had been looking up sites on asphyxiation and strangulation and loss of consciousness and all of this type of stuff. And we discovered that on the day that Mary was murdered, he was looking up sites on strangulation. So the case was growing.
Colin's grim search history stretched long before Mary's death. This was something he'd been planning for nearly a year. On July 4th, in the year 2000, he first searched the term asphyxia into an online dictionary to check its spelling. 6 weeks later, on August 17th, he typed in asphyxiate, and a couple of minutes later, how to asphyxiate. A few months passed before he returned to the subject, and on January 2nd, he spent hours looking up choking, smothering, and blocking the air supply. Things further escalated, and on January 29th, death by asphyxia. And by February 19th, 9 days before Mary's murder, he went on to search causes of death within seconds, an instant death.
It was horrendous. Like, we discovered then he was researching a guy in North Carolina called Henry Lewis Wallace, who was convicted of 9 murders of women. And in each time he strangled his victim without leaving a strangle mark. And he used a towel on several of the murders, and he used the towel to mop up the blood and that, like, you know. And he'd be at the scene himself when the police had arrived, like, you know. There's no doubt in our mind from the forensic evidence and from the fact that Colin Whelan had said that there was only the 2 of them in the house, that Mary Goff had gone up to have her shower, a wash, and he followed her up. He got ready his rope and waited for her to come out of the ensuite, and as she did, he strangled her.
Mary didn't have a chance. She stood up 5'4" as Colin towered over her, tightening his pull of the ligature.
But he didn't realise that Mary could actually fight for her life, and twisted round and got to scratch him. And twisting round, he lost a little bit of control and burned her neck with the rope. And the towel would have moved, leaving a lot of Mary's blood and stuff. He then dragged her down the stairs, which led to the burn marks on her bottom. And he got the duvet and covered her in the duvet. And with the towel, he mopped up the bit of blood and stuff around her mouth and nose and that, you know. He didn't do any CPR. He made the phone call and waited.
The PC had more to tell, much more in fact. While researching ways to kill his wife, Colin also found time to meet people online. The post-it note found in his work bin, "Roses are red, violets are blue," that wasn't written for Mary. It was written for a young woman named Helen Shepherd. In late December 2000, Colin and Helen met in an internet chat room under the name Celtic Tackle. He began what would become an intense cyber affair.
It was literally like a stream of consciousness. They would get up in the morning, he would text her, like it was this online chat, kind of a precursor to maybe what you would now do on WhatsApp.
Siobhan Gaffney is a former journalist and barrister from Dublin. She's the author of Till Death Do Us Part, a 2005 account of the Colin Whelan case.
And it was a lot of kind of in the early stages of emojis didn't exist at the time, but it was a lot of like little, you know, using the keyboard to do smiley faces and winky faces and all that kind of stuff. It was quite kind of childish in some regards, and it was a lot of saying how much they were going to get on when they would meet and what they would do and their future. Every day kind of messages over and back, over and back, over and back. But they did have like names for each other.
Both Colin and Helen would refer to him as Mr. Bear and Mr. Furry. The content of the messages soon escalated. Colin would begin to write her adoring notes and statements professing his growing love. One email in February 2001, weeks before Mary's death, contained a 500-word poem called Mr. Bear's Ode to a Welsh Bird. A segment read, "Exhaling of old breath, my insecurities conceive fear. My stomach filled with flutters, can't believe I'm really here. An embrace is made, I lower my face. Lips touch softly, and Mr. Bear's pulses race." I'm not going to question why I've created this bond. With this stable Welsh lady, who I am so fond. You never know, someday I wish I may visit to the land of Welsh dragons and most beautiful people in it. Love, Mr. Bear. Believe it or not, Colin's poetry left Helen enamoured. Their connection was mutual, and Pat was the person who'd have to break up the love in.
Now, I travelled to Wales, a place called Tonnerapandy in the Rhondda Valley.
He met a Welsh policeman and the pair drove to her house. From reading some of their correspondence, Pat knew she had fallen for him. They knocked on her door to deliver the news.
And she invited us in and she said, "What's all this about Colin Whelan? What's all this about Colin?" She says, "I haven't heard from him from the 28th of February. So she said, "Is he all right?" Oh, I said, "There's no bothering him." I says, but "You know, his wife is dead." And she said, "Yeah, he told me she was killed in a car crash." I says, no, she wasn't killed in a car crash. She says, "She was only killed the other night. And Colin is a suspect and we believe he killed her." And the poor woman just collapsed on the ground.
Pat sympathised with the young woman. None of this was her fault.
You're trying to break the news as easy as you can, but like at the end of the day, I just came out with it, like, you know, and she collapsed. And I remember one of the lads saying to me, he says, "What'd you do that for, you know?" I said, "Look, there's no easy way around this." But she understood then what we were there for and why. And I remember going into her kitchen and she had a big magnet on the fridge door and a picture of Colin Whelan. I remember taking it down and showing her and I said, "This is the Colin Whelan we're talking about." She said, "That's Colin Whelan." She said that she had every correspondence that he had sent to her, she had kept it, printed it out and kept it in a chronological order. And we said we wanted to see that and we needed to take a statement off her, but we certainly weren't going to take one off her now, like, you know.
Helen's shock quickly turned to anger.
Now she had her son and, you know, she says, "No, I'll be fine. I want to make a statement." So we had to download her computer, which took 12 hours to do.
Helen was a kind, young and quite vulnerable girl. Her mother had recently passed away, and in the midst of her grief, she decided to do some volunteer work in a local cancer charity.
But the charity gave her a laptop to facilitate her in doing the work. And this opened her up to chat rooms and stuff which she was never involved in before. And she went on to try it out, I guess, like, you know. And she was vulnerable. It was a bad time in her life. And she went in and she saw this guy, Celtic Tackle, who was Colin Whelan putting himself up as a different guy. He put himself up as a bodybuilder and looking for a relationship and this, that and the other. And she resonated to it and chatted him. And over a period of time, he confided in that, like, you know, that wasn't a picture of him. And he sent the right picture and she was even more enamoured, like, you know. But anyway, look, that was it.
When Pat got back to Ireland, he's able to get a full account of their exchanges to one another.
And you could see right up until the day, she wanted to come over that weekend and meet Colin. And he kept putting her off, saying he was in Germany and work and he couldn't meet her. And she wanted to come over, that he'd come over and meet her in Wales the following weekend or whatever, like, you know. And that was it. So it was getting fairly hot and heavy, but it took me leading her on, like, you know.
Nobody could measure what the Gough family went through. It was absolutely devastating for them all. She lost her only daughter and the lads lost their only sister. You could never measure how devastating that is. What they went through was hell, and they're still going through hell because it doesn't get any easier. Mary won't be back, and that's the really, really hard part to take in.
Next time on The Making of a Detective.
She was looking at the newspaper one night and the Goughs on their own band had done an article on Colin, and hey presto, the woman saw the picture in the paper and she read and she says, "Oh my good God, that's the guy, Cian Sweeney."
The Making of a Detective is brought to you by The Irish Sun. The series is written and produced by me, Ian Doyle. We will be back next Thursday for our second and final episode on the murder of Mary Gough. If you want to learn more about the life and career of Detective Pat Murray, check out his 2019 book, The Making of a Detective, by Penguin Books.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.